Thanks. So how is everyone this morning? Nice and early. It's probably the first time I've been awake this early in quite a little while. Actually, I got to see a sunrise, which is amazing because it doesn't happen very often for me. I'm more of a late night person. But today, I was late night and early morning. So today, we're going to talk about building connected Windows 8 apps with Windows Azure. My name is Nick Harris. I'm a technical evangelist for Windows Azure. My focus is somewhat sort of device scenarios plus Windows Azure. So I typically cover Windows Phone, Windows 8, a little bit of iOS and Android, but I'm certainly not an expert with those devices. I'm much better with the Win 8 and Win Phone. I work for Microsoft. I've been there for a little bit over a year. Prior to that, I've sort of been working in industry for 10 years. I sort of started out quite a bizarre history, really. I started out building software for helicopters with Ada 83, and then from that moved into the sort of .NET space, into an enterprise .NET shop, and built out sort of distributed systems and, I guess you could say, field automation systems using, back then it was Windows Mobile, so I sort of progressed through the mobile space in that particular way. So today we're really, who read the abstract? Did anyone get past the, okay, a couple of people. So today we're really going to focus on leveraging Windows Azure from our Windows 8 applications. And I guess I've sort of figured that most applications may use perhaps media location. So if you're building an application that needs to perhaps see points on a map and interesting things around you. So we're going to cover media, geolocation, and what's the last one? Push notifications. How can I forget? That's going to be my speciality. So we're going to deal with media, geolocation, and push notifications. So today it's actually level 300. So we're going to spend a lot more time in Visual Studio than in PowerPoint. That can be good and bad. Hopefully today it'll be a good experience. I've created a lot of snippets for my demo, so we can't really go wrong unless we get into trouble with some of the release preview bits. So let's move right along. So let's talk a little bit about the fundamentals. So when we talk about Windows Azure, we've got a few fundamental compute options. So we've actually got compute and storage options up there, as well as a whole bunch of platform services. But did everyone see the day one keynote? Okay, so essentially we've seen that typically today we're building apps on-prem, and when we're doing that, we need to go and manage everything essentially from the application, the code we're developing, all the way down to the hardware. When we go and start moving to sort of cloud-based environments, there's what we call the PaaS continuum. So you would have seen in the keynote that we had Mark Rasunovich up on stage, and he introduced the new feature being Windows Azure Virtual Machines. So if you look at this stack compared to the on-premise stack, pretty much you're doing everything in that space, including managing the OS, but you don't have to deal with any of the virtualization software or hardware. As we move along further, we sort of start getting less responsibility in the hardware space, and we can sort of start focusing more on our applications. So cloud services in Windows Azure essentially provides a few different types of roles. We've got what's called a web role, and that's essentially full IIS in a machine. You go, you build your application, you deal with data, whether you're connecting to SQL or SQL Azure Storage. We've got what's called startup tasks, so perhaps if you need to go and execute something to install every time that machine sort of is provisioned and spun up the first time, startup tasks are good for that. You can run native code, you can configure firewalls all in config. Essentially, you just build the app, package it, and deploy it. So one of the big announcements that they made, Scott Gu went out on stage and did a demo of that, was the Windows Azure websites. And essentially, this is a really lightweight, fast way to get your applications built and deployed up into Azure. And really, you don't really need to worry about anything more than writing the application code and pulling from your data sources, whatever they may be. So today, the app that we're building is going to be deployable to Windows Azure websites. And at the end, we'll try and push that up there. So that's basically Windows Azure Compute. if we talk about storage, we have several options available. Now, if you put a dividing line, I guess, down the bottom across SQL database, the first three options here are what we call Windows Azure Storage. Now, Windows Azure Storage provides three main types. The first one is table storage. And this is essentially a non-relational structured data store. It provides massive scale out. So if you want to go and, say, store up to 100 terabyte of data in a table, you can do that because our storage accounts by default will allow you to have 100 terabyte of data. You can have multiple accounts, and if you really are building this crazy application that does use more than that, and we do have quite a few that do that, you can actually call in and request up to, say, 5 petabyte of data on a single account. So that's amazing, really. We've got Windows Azure Blobs. So Blobs are essentially similar to, if you've heard Blob before, it's for binary data. So Blob storage is a great place to store images, video, documents, XML, these types of things. We've got Windows Azure Queues, so they're providing persistent async messaging. So if you want to sort of decouple your application, perhaps you're building an order processing system. You may have a web tier that's receiving orders, and then those orders may be enqueued into a Windows Azure Queue and later pulled off by a worker role that goes and reads that message and then goes and processes it and performs some work, perhaps pushing that into some wholesaler's distribution network. And lastly, we've got our SQL database. So this is recently rebranded, so some of you may be familiar with the term SQL Azure. Anyone in the room? Right, so SQL Azure has essentially been rebranded to SQL Database. I may interchange the terms because I'm still trying to not get in trouble from marketing, but I do on occasion forget. But essentially, with SQL Database, or Windows Azure SQL Database, all of your existing knowledge and skill sets in terms of, you know, creating tables, your T-SQL, stored procedures, all of that knowledge is transferable directly to here because essentially it's the same thing just running in Windows Azure. There are a few small differences, so some features are not supported. One, if you've been doing merge replication scenarios before, new sequential ID to new up. The new sequential ID function, for instance, to new up a GUID is not supported. You have to use row ID, and that's basically due to the way it's architected across multiple servers. So that's basically our storage. Wrong computer. Here we go. So let's look at Windows 8, and we're going to have four demos today. So I'm going to try and fly through the deck and focus on the important things, because as I said, it is a 300 level, and I'd like to show you a lot of code. But when we're building Windows 8 Metro apps, essentially we have three language options. We've got JS HTML, C# XAML, and C++. So could I get a show of hands of who's like a hardcore JS HTML developer? Okay. I think we had a couple. And what about C# XAML? Awesome. So I chose the right language to program the demo in. C++? Couple people. Cool. Maybe you guys should be up here presenting because that's pretty cool. Typically, I find C++ devs in general, they're like pretty capable when they move across different languages. So when we're building these apps, they can essentially call into what's called the WinRT API, and that exposes methods for us to, say, interact with our devices that are on the machine, network, you know, cameras, audio, these types of things. But today, we'll probably focus on the Windows 8 on the client side specifically. We're going to look at HTTP client. We're going to look at the camera capture UI. We're going to look at the geolocator class. And we're going to look at the push notification channel manager. On the server side, we're going to build out web APIs for pushing all this data up into Azure. And as the data stores in Azure, we're going to use Azure SQL Database and and Blob Storage. So, who's used web API before? A couple people. So essentially, a framework, lightweight framework for going and building out HTTP services that are consumable by multiple devices. And basically, the reason they're consumable by multiple devices is because you're just using a basic HTTP web request to pull and push data and then serialize or deserialize that data however you need. So, So for the new people in the room, that's set up the back. I just closed a file. Let's just double check. Is that readable? Awesome. Okay. I wonder why it creates that empty solution every time I open a file. Don't normally do it like that. But anyhow, so we're going to create a new project. And we'll start at the server side. So with, you'll note here what I'm doing is I'm changing from .NET 4 to .NET 4.5, .NET 4.5 to .NET 4. And this is specifically because at the moment in Azure, you can't run .NET 4.5. It's not released yet in terms of, you know, the stable official RTM. It's sort of, what's it at the moment? Beta or something like that? Is it? I think it just progressed past that. But .NET 4.5 doesn't run in Azure sort of natively. It's not supported yet. Once it's released to market, it'll be up in there, so you can then target that. So today we're going to build out our services with .NET 4. And if I select web, do an MVC 4 application. So we'll select Web API as the default project type. Sometimes I wish that my machine was like just that little bit faster, but it's pretty reasonable at the moment anyhow. But what we've just done is we've created a new MVC application. So those of you, has anyone built like a cloud service project for Windows Azure before? So the first thing you'll notice is there's no Azure project, there's no cloud project in this solution. And because when we're targeting Windows Azure websites, we don't need that anymore. We can basically just web deploy or FTP that application up there. But what this has dropped in is essentially a web API, a default web API here. So this demo, we're just going to do the basics, and then we'll sort of jump straight in and start building out those other scenarios. So who's an MVC developer? Few people. So with web API, essentially your controller is inheriting from this special thing called API controller. And this is how it knows that it's a web API. What we've got here is simple get, post, put, and delete operations. So what we're going to do is we're going to spin this up. And we're just going to call it from the browser first before we build a client application. So this maps this controller to values. And we just executed a simple get operation. And you can see that that's returned value 1 and value 2. So now we're going to go and call that from a Win8 metro app. So we select Windows Metro style. Now that's obviously .NET 4.5. Select a blank application template. So let's get started. So what we're going to do here is we're going to use HTTP client to call into that service. I use control dot to resolve those. It's sort of my favorite thing, and you'll see me use that a lot today. So we new up the client, and then we say response is equal to client dot, what is it, get async. We'll provide our URI. This is where I just need to grab the port so we know where our local host is going to run. For every subsequent demo, we'll say API slash values. So you'll note that I'm wrapping these two calls in using statements, and that's essentially because both of these implement dispose. So it means that I don't have to do, you know, your try and finally blocks. Using essentially will do that when you build the application. So now what we've done is we've actually wired up this to go and call into that service and return the values. But what you'll note here is this is async, and we've got a build error at the moment. So this is saying that type used and using. Yeah, so I'm missing the new await syntax, which you'll probably be doing a lot of if you're building applications in Windows 8 and with .NET 4.5. But essentially, if you've ever wired up a callback before, what the await syntax is doing is saying, when I call out, you typically use it, and the methods are there for when you're calling out to network or something that's going to take some time. It just means everything that immediately follows that is going to be wired up into a callback automatically for you. So you're not going to have to wire up, say, a completed event or something like that. So now we should have a result. Yep. And we read it as a string so we can read it. This one is awaitable as well, because we're doing I/O. That's basically it. So let's put a breakpoint here. Let's spin up our services. All right. And when that guy's ready, now we'll hit it with our app. Right. So now you can see that we've actually successfully called into that service and it's returned back a result. Now, you'll see that the format that's used here by default isn't XML, it's JSON. And you can go and set a request header. You can set your request header to say accept text XML, for instance, if you want the web API to return that. But one of the key points or key takeaways I'd like you to have today is when you're building out scalable systems with Windows Azure, you really need to think about serialization strategy, because this is going to have a significant impact on when you need to scale and also, you know, cost to your back pocket. So if we look at this little case study here, it's essentially 8 patient records. And that's intentionally small because I wanted to fit those whole 8 patient records into the screen here. So you can see, like, you can't even read that. That's how compressed it has to be. So for that 8 patient record serialized back from a WCF data service, it was 8.5 KB. When we went to WCF REST, that come back and it's 1.2 KB. And if we utilize JSON, as Web API does by default, you'll see that that text is obviously a lot more readable, and that was 639 bytes. So that's 13 times difference from the far left to the far right. So what's that mean to you as a developer? If you have, say, one instance of a web role or something like that running, there's a constrained network I/O that you have on that. And essentially, you're going to be able to keep hitting that machine until that network, you know, bottoms out or tops out, or the CPU. But if we're just talking straight network, you may be getting, say, on the left, you'll be getting, let's say, if we're getting 13 million requests using JSON, you'd only be getting 1.3 million requests using OData here, and that's on one instance. So essentially, if you wanted to utilize OData in this case, you'd have to scale out 13 times, so it's going to be pretty much 13 times the cost there. So that's a really important takeaway for today. Right, so now we're going to go deep pretty fast that we've done the basics. So let's talk about media. We're going to look at how we can capture it, upload it to storage, being Windows Azure Blob Storage, and then download that back into the application. But there's a few key best practices that you need to know about when you're building out storage solutions using Windows Azure. And the first one is, you know, how do we keep secrets a secret? So when I say a secret, if you are a SQL developer, you have a username and password that you use to connect to a database. When we talk about Windows Azure Storage, you have an account name and account key. You don't want them on the device. If they're on the device, someone can reverse engineer your application, pull out those keys, and then they've got 100 terabytes of storage that they can do whatever they want with. It does happen. So this is what you do not do. You don't have your device connecting directly. In this case, that grid is table storage. What we do is we can proxy the requests. So this is a very typical pattern. And what that essentially means is now that our keys sit behind, say, a web API or a WCF service or whatever you choose to use, our keys sit here. So our client is essentially requesting to that service to perform an action on its behalf. And then we go and send that data, if we're uploading data, to the table there. And then likewise with blob storage, we may want to be serializing an image up into blob storage. So one method that you can do for that is to upload that directly to your web role, then have it serialized into blob storage. So has anyone ever uploaded a file via a web role or website or something like that before? Come on, couple guys. So who's used this approach with Azure before? Okay, great. So I'm going to show you a much better way to do this. So with blob storage in particular, we've got what's called a shared access signature. Now, in the prior slide, we were serializing that media directly through our web rolling up. But if you think about that media, it may be perhaps 1 meg, it may be 5 meg, it could be quite large, right? So if you're serializing data through that web roll, again, you're going to be sort of putting additional load on this web roll in terms of the network I/O. And with blob storage, we've got what's called shared access signatures, and that provides a way for you to avoid doing that, and I'll show you how they work. So a shared access signature, you can think of it as just a time box token that you can request and generate that allows you to perform an action against your storage, whether it's write to the storage account or read private data from the storage account. So the way we do that is we have our device request into, say, a web API or something like that for a shared access signature. Your web role generates this shared access signature using your storage account name and key and returns it to the device. So that shared access signature is only, say, it's well under a KB. It's only maybe 40 to 100 characters long. So compare that to uploading a meg of data through your web role. So what happens is we get that shared access signature. Now we can directly read, if it's a private resource, if we've generated the shared access signature for that, we can read that directly from blob storage, or we can write directly to blob storage. So it's quite a powerful way of offloading that that sort of large amount of data from your web role directly to the Windows Azure storage APIs. So we'll see how to do this today. So big announcement that happened yesterday. So for those of you who are Azure developers, pretty much shared access signatures historically were only supported on blob storage. They've now released shared access signature support for table storage and queues. So that's quite big. So let's jump in here. So we're going to look at storing media in Windows Azure Blob Storage using a shared access signature. So this is where we're going to get pretty deep. Let me pull this guy down for a bit. So I'm going to start in the portal. So we need to provision a storage account. And you would have seen this in Scott Goo's presentation. So if I come to my storage option here, I can actually create a new storage account. We'll use Quick Create. And we'll call it TechEd12, and it's available. And we're going to drop this storage account into East US. So this is going to take perhaps around a minute, and this is going to provide that account which we can go and use up to a storage, go and use up to 100 terabyte of data in this one. So while that happens, let's go out and build our web API. So if I come along, we're going to add a new controller. I'm still in debug mode. Let me Alt F4 out of that guy. So let's add our web API. We're going to call this guy blob sass controller. Going to use an empty template. How are you still debugging? There we go. I think my screen is a bit all over the place here. Let's get it a little bit more real estate. Okay. Just make sure that worked. Okay, so to create a shared access signature is actually quite straightforward. And here is my Uber snippet skills. It actually took 7 hours to create all of these snippets after devving the application. So you'll see that I've dropped in some source here, and we'll step through that in a second. But we need a few references to be able to start using these things. So the first one's a cloud storage account, and this is essentially the class that allows us to interoperate with that storage account we're creating. And to utilize that, we need a reference to Windows Azure.storage client. Hit OK on that, and we'll hit Control Dot on this guy, and that'll add a using statement for that. So we'll just resolve any other ones here. There's an invalid token somewhere. Sorry? Ah. Epic. So that's just us nerves. So we need to create a function. So when we create a blob, we need to know a couple things to create that and the shared access signature for it. We need to know the container, which is essentially similar to a folder, but they're not nested. That's why we call them containers rather than folders to avoid confusion. So we're going to put a simple get operation here that accepts a container and blob name. Now what we've got over here is another class, which is probably one you haven't seen before if you're an Azure dev. It's called Cloud Configuration Manager. Now this is a NuGet package that the guys have built out and released. And essentially what it is now that we've got these two deployment strategies, we can deploy to Windows Azure websites, which doesn't have a cloud project, or we can deploy to WebRoll, which does have a cloud project. There's no such thing in this now as a CSCFG when we're deploying to Windows Azure websites. So what this class does, essentially, it says, well, I'm going to try and get a setting, say, from my app settings in the CSCFG file, if it's a cloud project. If that doesn't exist, which it does in this case, it's going to go and look in my web config. So that's going to save you a lot of code, and it means you're sort of portable going between Windows Azure websites model up to cloud services model. So we need to drop in a connection string here. We'll call it data. And we need to say value. So if you're using cloud services, this is automated for you, but not in websites. Default endpoints protocol. I didn't snippet this one. So we're going to use HTTPS for all our comms, account name, and account key. So where did these come from? Well, they come from the storage account that's still creating. So let's go back here and see what's happening. We've got a nice little progress bar here. So it says it's complete. So I'll try a different type of refresh here. There we go. It's just a little UI issue. So what we've got now is we've got our access key. So actually, I'm going to need anyone from the audience want to participate? I have a volunteer. All right. Can you remember this for me? No, we can copy that out. We can copy that out. So let's copy that, and we've named this TechEd 12. So TechEd 12 and the key. Yeah. I'm not actually sure why the keys are so long. I think it looks like it's encoded or something, but I think I'd prefer something a bit shorter. But anyhow, that's our connection string. So let's come back here now. So what we're doing is we get a reference to our storage account using that connection string. We then create what's called a blob client. Now this is just something that allows us to go and utilize all the methods for manipulating blobs or storage. And what we're doing here is we're saying get a container reference. So if I pass in, say, my container, we're getting a handle to this container, and we're going to say, well, if that container doesn't exist, let's create it so we can store blobs within it. Now, shared access signatures, as we mentioned, are essentially a way to allow you to write to this sort of resource which may not be publicly accessible. So what we're going to do is we're going to set up a policy that allows us to essentially give that time-boxed period of time that someone can come and access this resource. And we're going to call this my policy. So the first thing that we're doing is we're saying, well, for this container, we're going to make it publicly readable, but to write to it, you need a shared access signature. And I'm making this container publicly readable because I want my client application to be able to easily get these, easily pull down these images, because perhaps I want to share them with my friends or something like that. But if you wanted to make that container completely private, so no one on the internet can sort of find that URL or browse to it, well, then you can make it private simply by specifying access to off, and then use the shared access signature for your read permissions as well. So in this case, we're going to just have public readable blobs, but we're going to use a shared access signature to write to blob storage. If we had this turned off and we also wanted people to be able to read from this shared access signature, we'd add the read permission in there. Now, if you want your time box period to start immediately when this signature is generated, you don't set the start access time. If you want it to start 4 hours in the future, 10 hours in the future, you specify this. And expiry time, we're going to set it to 4 hours. We set the permissions on the blob, and then we generate the shared access signature and return it back to our client. So that's basically generation of a shared access signature. So now we need to go and write something on the client that's going to take that photo and then upload it to storage using this shared access signature. So let's come back to our main page here in the client application. And we're going to see if these are still here. Great. So I'm going to add an app bar on here. Now, this app bar is essentially going to allow me to click a button and take a photo. So let's, okay, F7 into the back. Now, first thing we need to use is the camera capture UI. So this is a WinRT API. We'll call this camera. Now, so that news up our camera, which allows us to put up a dialogue to take a photo. But what I want to do for later, for my push notifications, we're going to send this picture as a tile. So I'm going to set an aspect ratio for that. So tile notifications need to be in a particular aspect ratio. If it's wide, it needs to be 310 by 150. And if it's square, I think it's 110 by 110. Or is it 150 by 150? Doesn't matter if the aspect ratio is the same. It should scale it. But let's set that here so when we come back to it, we'll be able to go and do that. So I think it's width first. So this is going to provide us a cropping capability. And now let's capture the media by camera.capturefile. And mode, well, we might want to choose photo or video. We need to make this is an async function, so we'll wait on that. Specify this as async. And that should now get us our photo. Now, what's the next thing we need to do? We've built out our service that returns back a shared access signature. We need to call into that to get the shared access signature so we can then serialize this image directly up to Blob storage rather than via our web role. So we call get blob sass, and here is my handy little snippet. I inject things that don't build, so I don't forget to say come and set the appropriate port for this sample. So if we come down here, it'll be running on this. So what you can see here is that's going to go to APIs blob sass. We're going to pass in a container and blob name. So if you look at our method signature here, you can see that's it basically there. So let's go back to our client and look through the code for retrieving that. So this is basically the same as the sample that we started with at the start in terms of calling and performing a get against a web API. So you can see we've got our client. We call into that service and get a response. That's our URL that we defined up the top. We're specifying my test container, and we've got a media name back from the file. So that's going to be like image1.jpg. If that's successful in returning the result, we're going to do something with that URL. So now we're going to stream that or push that directly to Blob storage using the REST APIs. So pretty much all of Windows Azure has a REST API that you can utilize. In our website, we've been using like a nice to manage wrapper with our, say, cloud storage account and that sort of thing. That then calls into the REST APIs. On the Windows 8 Metro app, we don't yet have a client library for doing all of this. So you can go back to using the basic REST operations. So here we're going to do upload blob. So what we're simply doing here is we take our media and we get a stream from that. We create a stream content and pass in our file stream. We specify the content type, so this will be like image/JPEG for our images. And then we simply call send async to upload this directly to our SAS URL. So this is our shared access signature that we configured for write permissions. So that's that. So I think with this, we'll build it and we'll run it. No major demo failures so far, apart from remembering to put my method in the shared access signature service. So there's our services are up and running. Let's spin this guy up. Put a breakpoint perhaps here, and we'll put one once he finishes uploading in there. So let's spin up the client. We've still got that from the first one, which we can remove. So Where is our up bar? There's our up bar. So I'm right-clicking here. We've got a nice up bar. We can take a photo. And boom. So this is something that is very important to remember, and I forgot, but I'll show you where you can do that. So essentially that's saying to me, your Metro app is not allowed to have permissions to the camera unless you've declared that. And that's basically so when a user is downloading an app from the store, they can see what like device peripherals and those sorts of things you want to use. So perhaps if you're developing some simple game, there may be no need for that game to have access to the camera. So we want our consumers to be aware that, hey, they're using the camera for some particular reason. But in this case, because we're capturing photo or video, we're going to enable webcam and microphone. So now if we spin this up, we'll be able to utilize that. So services, client. Let's hit photo. Looks good. Do we want to allow the app to use it? Yes. Oh, that's not very friendly, is it? Maybe at this angle. Okay. So I've just changed camera to this really cool one here. So do you guys want to have your photo taken? Anyone? Do you want to wave? So let's sort of the best angle I can get. So there we go. So we've taken that, and you can see this is that aspect ratio that we set before. So let's hit OK. And there's our breakpoint. So we've hit the media. So we've captured that media successfully. Now if I put a breakpoint here, hit F5, now we've got our shared access signature. So you can see what that looks like out here. We've got our image, but this is our shared access signature that our service generated for us. That's essentially going to allow us to write to Blob Storage directly from this client without exposing a key. In 4 hours, no one will be able to use this anymore. So it's really a good way to restrict access to that. If you wanted to set it to 5 minutes, you could do so. So let me hit F5 here. And now we can see that that's occurred, and we've got a response of created there. So that's really cool. So that's our app. Let me Alt-Tab back here. So let's add a storage account connection here. So we've got a Storage Explorer, TechEd 12. And let me come back to the portal. I'll grab that key. Did you forget it yet? No, okay. So we'll save that, we'll use HTTPS, and we'll hit OK. So now what we're able to do from right within Visual Studio here is navigate in and see, hey, it's created that My Test Container. What's within that? Picture one. So there we go. And you can see that that's served directly from the web. Pretty cool, all right? What do you guys think? Hey. we should have got that on video. Okay. So let's move along back to the slides, and we'll come back to this because we can make this even better. But first, I guess what I'd like to do at the end of each section is say, what are some of the next steps? So obviously we're doing a demo here. I've got an hour. Actually, I've got 36 minutes left, so I'm going to have to start rushing. But I really want you guys to take away what are the next things that you should be doing if you're building out these scenarios. So you saw within our Blob Shared Access service that we created the container if it did not exist. We've got these create if not exist options on table client, blob client, queue client. And basically what they're saying is it's like if the resource that you're trying to utilize doesn't exist, go and create it first. And in doing that, there's some overhead in calling into your API. So if you've got something that's doing a tight loop or something like that, and you're calling, say, create if not exist on this container every time, there's overhead in that it's going to take a little bit of time to go out and check if that container exists. If it doesn't exist, it creates it the first time. But if that loop is going through 100 times, you're really sort of slowing down your application code, and you're incurring storage transactions. So there's a cost to that as well. So in this particular scenario, since the client can send up their container name, you typically have to call it every time. But if you know in advance what those containers are going to be, perhaps every user has their own container name. You only need to create that once. So that's something you do perhaps during user sign-up. You'd go and create that container, and then you'd never have to really call that again. Other things, upload large file. So, you know, if you're taking video, it could be 100 meg. You don't really want to just stream that all up in one thing. You can parallelize that workload and upload that blob in blocks. If you want to take this a step further, we've got what's called the Windows Azure CDN. So this is a content delivery network, and we've got over, I think it's 24 or 26 nodes globally now. So essentially, if you want users to be viewing that resource, if it's, say, a media file, you can utilize the CDN URL on top of your blob storage, and that will move that image, say, if I'm in Australia, it'll move it to our node in sort of the Sydney area. That then means that anyone trying to access that from Sydney, they're going to get it really nice and fast, rather than having to come all the way here to East US to pull that down. We've also got, or recently announced, Windows Azure Media Services. So if you're doing a lot of video type stuff and you want to encode it for different devices, you can utilize Windows Azure Media Services for that. And the last one, I actually slipped it into the demo last night, but use Cloud Configuration Manager to allow portability between Windows Azure websites and cloud services. So with that, let's talk about geolocation. So what we're going to try and do in this section is just have enough of the fundamentals to add a point of interest or a location, and this point of interest is going to be a picture. We're going to add that point of interest at a defined latitude and longitude into a SQL Azure DB that we're going to create. And then we're also going to create a radial search that says, retrieve to me all the points within a certain distance of where I currently am. So, what are the basics? So in Windows 8, we've got what's called the geolocator class within the Windows devices geolocation namespace. And then for data storage, we could have chosen Windows Azure Table Storage to store this location data, but that doesn't really provide sort of an in-memory querying option in terms of the same as SQL Server or SQL Database. SQL Database, same as your on-prem SQL Server, your offloading the execution of, say, a query to that server. With Windows Azure Table Storage, you need to pull back your data and then perform your operations against that in memory in this particular case, because if you're trying to do a radial search by distance, there's no built-in method in Windows Azure Table Storage that can do that type of search. So you'd be writing your own algorithm and pulling that data back into memory and searching it, so it's not as efficient. So we choose SQL Database here. So two key points to note is that we do have flat earth and curved earth type. So if you want to represent the earth as a flat object, you use geometry. If you want to utilize a curved earth, then we use geography, and that's what we're going to use. So perhaps a good way to explain that is if you were trying to calculate the distance from point A to point B, if that's a long way away, a curved earth, you've got sort of the circumference or radius. So it's further to fly, say, from point A to point B like that. But if you're looking top down on a map, a flat earth, a point-to-point distance doesn't take into account that curvature. So one of the key things that we'll use here is what's called well-known text. It's essentially a way we can represent in a string a point. So in this case, we're going to use point, longitude, latitude. I don't know why it's back that way. I think it's by standard, but I always tend to get it mixed up and I use latitude than longitude. But that's something to sort of keep note of. We're going to look at two key methods here, the ST from WKT. I think that should be ST point from well-known text, from text. Slight typo there, but essentially the method, and I'll point it out when we get there, takes some text and turns it into a geography data type for SQL Server. ST distance is going to be used for our radial search, and I've got a bit.ly link out there for more details on what's supported. So let's jump into the demo. So 30 minutes, we're sort of doing okay. Right, so we need a SQL database. So what I'll do here is I'm going to create a website with database attached. Because we'll use a website later to deploy. So let's say location tech ed is going to be the name of our website. We'll create it with a database, tech ed. We're going to create a new SQL database in East US. Going to hit next, and we'll call it location tech ed DB. And if we wanted to provision a new SQL Server, we could. I've already got a number of them already provisioned, but creating a logical server in SQL Azure is quite straightforward. Essentially, you just hit new server database, and then you choose a region, and it'll go out and provision that, and then you can create multiple DBs against it. We'll use one I've already got here. So I'm going to choose a server. We'll use this one. And we'll put in the username and word. Hit OK. So this is going to provision an empty Windows Azure website for us to deploy to later, and also a Windows Azure SQL database. There it is there, location ticket DB. So we can see here now in the portal that that was provisioned in my server there. And one key thing that will hit developers up if you're developing locally is that you need to add firewall rules. So by default, nothing can really connect to that server apart from your Windows Azure websites or your sort of any resource that you've got in Azure. To connect locally, you need to add a firewall rule. So that's really cool because it essentially means you're not allowing, you know, random people to connect to your DB publicly. But for dev purposes, I want to do that. So you can see here you come in on a specific LAN, and if I wanted to say here, I'd say start IP address, end IP address. So that would be just this IP. But sometimes when you're connecting outbound from a particular network, different networking environments, sometimes your public IP will change. So typically I'll put a range in. So you can see I've got a range here for everything to say I can connect. So that's matching, so we're cool. We should be able to get going with this. So let's go back to our database. Here and here. Now, I have seen it happen before. I'd appreciate it if no one connects to this and goes and plays with my data. So, because I did open up a whole range there, and you're probably on the same IP range. So I'm going to copy this server URL. So you can see the connection strings essentially puts out our connection strings if we want to consume it from ADO.NET, ODBC, PHP, JDBC there. But I'm going to take that, and I'm going to go to, close this guy, where's my server explorer, I'm going to add a new connection here. And that's going to connect to that DB. I'm going to use this. Oh, yes, you guys don't know the password until I put it into clear text. But anyhow, so we called this our DB. Just going to hit OK there. So now we're connected from Visual Studio directly to that DB. So we can start executing some queries against that. So we need to scaffold the DB here. So who here is an Entity Framework person? And are you using Entity Framework 5? Okay, no, that's still in RC, and it's not supported in Windows Azure yet because it takes a dependency on .NET 4.5. So when that becomes public, you'll be able to use Entity Framework within there because it will be supported. So we're going to remove Entity Framework here for a second while I remember, jumping around a little bit. But you can see I've just removed Entity Framework 5. This is a NuGet Package Manager console. So where I added the reference to the Windows Azure Configuration Manager through the UI before, I typically prefer console because I find it faster if you know the package name. And now let me install while I remember. Entity, come on, Nick. Framework. This is going to drop in one which will run up in Azure when we deploy version 4.3, the current public bits. Right. So let's say new query at this level. What I'm going to do now is scaffold our DB. So Entity Framework 5, really cool. You can use code first. So you just write a class, and then you go and generate the database from that class. I really wanted to show that today, but as I said, I can't. So what we're going to do is we're going to create our database schema, and then we're going to use the EF Designer to import a couple stored procedures that we can call into. So let's drop this create table script in. So let's have a look at it. So the first thing that we've got here is a point of interest table. And the key point to note is that we've got the geography data type. And that's where we're going to store location. And we're going to store a URL to blob storage for an image that we're going to upload and associate to this. Now we've got a get points of interest radial search. So this is going to say if I pass in an origin, I can find anything within a particular radius of that origin. So I've got a simple query here that selects from point of interest, it uses the location row to say, find me everything. Did I just go past it? There we go. Find me everything within a distance of an origin to that location. So it's going to check, I send in an origin, and it's going to go, is this location within my radius? Is the next location in the next row within my radius? And it's going to filter and send back that subset. We're using ST point from text, which is essentially that well-known text format which we talked about. Again, if you're using EF5, we've got spatial data type support. In EF4.3, there's no spatial data type support. So I'll put up a slide when we get through this demo to show you the differences between, you know, the now versus the you know, future soon-ish. And then our last one is to create a point of interest, because perhaps, you know, we want to be able to search to return all these, but we need to be able to insert them into our DB as well. So that's basically it. And I'm just putting a temporary point in here just so I have one piece of data to show you guys. So let's execute this. It's going to go and scaffold our DB. Cool. So that's done. Now we got to do quite a lot of work. So this one's a lot more effort than the last one. And with, as I said, with EF code first, it becomes really awesome. I actually wrote this using EF code first the first time just to play with it. So we're going to create what's called a location controller here. And essentially, we want to surface up those two methods for our client to call into. The get to get the points within a radius, and also the insert. So here's our location controller. We've got that there like that. But what we need to do first is you can see that this is calling into to code that doesn't exist. So we need to create that data tier. Let's come back to that. Should have been, let's create our data tier so we can actually call into it from our controller. Add new item. We're going to use data, ADO.net data model, generate from database. Going to select that connection to our cloud-based storage. So what you're noticing here as well, which is really cool, is we're developing against real assets that are deployed up in Azure. We're not doing it locally. You could if you wanted to, but I'm just doing this to demonstrate the point that we can. And we're going to call this location entities as the connection string in our web config. Going to hit next, and you'll see that, lo and behold, there's our two points of interest. We're not going to scaffold the point of interest table because EF4.3 doesn't support the location data type. Call it model namespace, and we'll hit finish. So this is going to go and drop in that designer view for me. If you think I should have a faster machine, please tweet Cloud Nick and at James Conn, that's my manager. Might be able to get me some more RAM or something like that. But here's our design surface, and if we'd have chosen to put the table in, it would be here, but we really only need the stored procedures. So you can see that they are mapped over here in the model browser. I just clicked that. So I'm going to double-click on get points of interest because by default I don't like the type that it generates for those set of data that's returned. I really want it to be something a bit nicer. So I'm going to call it point of interest. And you can see here that I'm returning back, I'm sort of flattening out that geography data type to have latitude and longitude. So hit OK. Now that should have gone and done that for me. The other thing I want to do is I want to add an online reference here because there's a little extension here called EF4 DB context generator. And that's going to give me that a strongly typed DB context that's much nicer than the default EF template. It's got a much reduced surface and it's really easy to utilize. You'll see that in a second. So I'll add that guy in there. And that's done. So now let's build this. That should be our data model done. You can see here now we've got our nice point of interest being generated for us. And we've got our DB context called location entities. And this has got our two methods for calling in to our stored procedures. So let's go back and now add that location controller. Realized I'm running low on time. We've got 20 minutes left. So let's scaffold this guy in. Now that we've got our data tier, we can actually resolve these references. Now, we've got a get that will return back our points of interest, and we've got a post that essentially accepts a point of interest from the client and inserts it into the DB. So let's have a look at how we interact with this that we've just generated. We can say get points of interest, and then we can say string.format. We'll take that well-known text, and we'll put in the longitude. We need the template type first, sorry. Well-known text format, longitude. Second replacement is latitude. And then that's it for that guy. And then we want to specify the radius that we want to search on. And that's that. What's our error here? Put a return statement in, and that's going to return back a list of point of interests. So now we need to build our client application. So there's a fair bit of code here because we're going to essentially wire up to get the points of interest, but also to insert a point of interest. And we're going to display them on a Bing Maps control. So let's get cracking. So within my grid here, I'm going to add a Bing Map control. But first, you need to add a reference to that. So at the moment, this is a release preview version of Bing Map. So I have had a few issues with it, but hopefully we'll be able to resolve them. The first thing you'll note is that it says, hey, there's little warnings there. What are you doing here? Dock that back in there. And it's saying, hey, the CPU type or target is wrong. So I'm not sure why they don't allow you to target any CPU, because you can target all the options. But we'll go and specify our app to make it happy to target x86. That'll resolve that issue. If we build it now, that's fine. Now we need to use the map. So let's define what namespace we're using. We'll call Bing Maps, and we'll say using Bing.maps. This is where I've had trouble with this guy. That seems to have resolved. Now I'm going to drop in the mapping control. Try and build that again. Saying it doesn't exist. This is more because they're sort of release preview bits, and that will typically fix it. Let's my tap events here aren't working either. So let me just do this first. Let's talk about what's here, and then we'll go and fix that. So we've got a map, which currently isn't resolving for some reason, but we'll get there. And that map has a zoom level and a credential that allows us to utilize the Bing Map service. So that's freely available online. They do have T's and C's, which you should read. And then essentially we're going to want to show the image if we tap on a point, or play some video if we tap on a point. So let me come in here and just wire up that tapped event handler. And we'll say image.tapped is equal to, and then we'll say sender as UI element dot visibility is equal to collapsed, because that's right, yeah. When I tap the image, I want it to disappear, and we'll put in the show in a bit. And we'll say video.tapped is plus equal to, we'll just put it into the same one because that'll work. So let's see, this map is still giving me some grief. Okay, seems to have resolved. So do that and it will work, but I assume once the bits are like cleaned up, you're not going to have these problems. It is because it's not internal, it's publicly available, but it's a very early release of the control. So let's do something here. So what we'll do is let's write the code to add that point of interest back in. Now we defined a point of interest type. So what I like to do is I like to have the capability to come in and utilize that same type in my client project. So I like to add an existing item, come up, select my models, and this is my generated one, and I say add as link. So essentially what I get then is if I change that type, say the schema or something that's being returned, then that's automatically going to be reflected in my client code base. Let's get that guy out of there. Now we need to, so this is our code that we had before for taking the picture and uploading the blob. The last thing we want to do is add the point of interest. So let's specify where that's going to be. We need to add this, drop this in there. So that's our URI for doing the post, which we have here to insert into the DB. So come back down. Now what we do is we utilize a memory stream and the JSON data contract serializer to serialize that point of interest to the payload of a HTTP post request and push that straight up through our location service. So here we specify the serializer, we specify the type that we're serializing, we specify the values. Let me control dot that guy. Let's do that again. Okay, it's not working. We'll come back to that. We specify the values, we'll define the current location in a second when we wire up the geolocator class, and we specify the URL. So we're just essentially newing up a point of interest that has a reference to our URL for that blob that we upload. We then stream that in, and we post that up. The last thing we do is we want to add a push bin to the map, because we don't really want to round trip up to the server to pull down something that we've already created. Build this. Resolve the references, so this is all Bing Maps namespace. And let's create the tapped event. So when I click on a push pin, I want to show the image. So essentially what this does is, let's define a push pin, let's take the description and put it in, let's set its position on the map to the location of the point, let's add that to the map, let's set the tag of that push pin to the URL so that when we click it, we can take that tag and specify that that image or video control is now visible on the UI. So that's that bit. Now let's come back up and let's wire up our geolocator. Call it geolocator type. Geolocator. New geolocator. Now again, same as before, we need to specify a capability. The capabilities tab to allow the use of location. All right, so that's our location. So now what we can do is we can say geolocator.positionChanged and put in a handler for when the position changes. So when our geolocator determines that the position has changed, we get a new latitude and longitude coming in here through the arguments. And when I get that, here's my little make sure that I put it in the package apex manifest, because I always forget. When we do get that location back, we want to do something with it. Async. We want to, this essentially fires on a thread that's not the UI thread. So we utilize what's called the dispatcher to delegate that task to run on the UI thread, and we go off and we add a push pin. We set our current location to the coordinates that we received back from the geolocator, and then same as before, we go and add that to the map and we set the center of the map. So let me control dot this guy. So that just generated a property stub for the location data type from Bing Maps where I can just store my current location. Now you'll note I'm doing this in the code behind. At the moment, the control doesn't support binding the Bing Maps control. So that's something that I'm not sure if it's on the roadmap. I hope it is, but there's definitely forum posts on there which you can go and comment if you want to be able to data bind to a collection of push pins. So once we get our current position, we want to get that radial search or get all the points of interest around me. So we get points of interest, and again, it's a very familiar pattern that you're starting to see emerge here. We call into our location API and we pass in the latitude, longitude, and radius in meters. So this is our method signature here. Right. So Need to define this as async. Need to resolve the HTTP status code. So what we do now is we call into that and we say, well, if it returned back OK, let's deserialize the points of interest that return back from that service, enumerable point of interest. Then we say, let's read the stream, the content that's coming back into a stream. Let's use the same method that we serialized the point of interest up there to deserialize it, but this time we expect a list of them. And then we essentially read from the stream that's come back in the response, and we've got our list of points of interest. Iterate through them and add push pins. So that one's got quite a bit in it. So I tried to break it up, but it's sort of hard to compress this into the amount of time for what we're trying to do. So let's spin this guy up. So let's have a look at our get points of interest. So at the moment, I'm doing a radial search that is 9,000 kilometers or 9 million meters. And I did that because I put essentially a point all the way over the other side of the map. So let's spin up our client. Hit allow. So what's happening now is the geolocator's actually taking our public IP and determining where we are. If you had GPS in your device, it would know. And you can see that that's me there. It's not that, you know, perfect for using a public IP. If it was using GPS, we'd be fine. Let's add a point of interest. Allow it to use our webcam. Oh, that always is scary. Do you guys, I got to change camera. Do you guys want another photo? Okay. Thanks. Great audience. So I don't want to leave anyone out, so let's try and get you all in. Hit OK. Now, let's disable these because that was our initial upload that we talked about. Hit OK. Now that's going to go, and that's uploaded our image. Hit F5, and it's added our point of interest, and you can see that there. So if I click on this now, that tapped event handler is going to occur, and we pulled it down from blob storage. Pretty cool. All right. Okie dokie. So let's just zoom right out here for a second. And you can see that, ta-da, there's that other point that I had in the bottom of my SQL script that essentially adds a picture of the ceiling because I got bored of taking pictures of myself. Right. So if you wanted to upload video, it's quite the same. So let's use this camera. Go to video mode, just so you guys can see how easy like the API is giving us. Do you guys want to applaud or boo, whichever you prefer? Okay. There we go. And you can see now that's the playback. Some cool things, you can come in and you can trim and edit video on the fly. So fast forward everyone. Okay. And we hit OK. Now that's going to go and upload our video. Now let me navigate back over to here. You can see the video points there. Let's hit OK. Now that's going to go, grab the video if I clicked on the point, and there's the video playing back to us now as well, straight out of storage. So pretty cool. So let's, I got 6 minutes left, so we do have push notifications, and I think it's worth showing them. What have I got in the deck here? Let's do this. We did EF 4.3.1, but with EF5 and spatial data, you can essentially go and define your type, and we've got the new DB geography type here. So that allows you to go and essentially remove all that legwork that I did before with scaffolding the DB, writing those queries and such, and then generating things in the designer. If we define our data type like this, and then we define a location context like this, the DB set essentially tells EF when it scaffolds the DB that we're going to create a point of interest table. Now, querying back is really cool because now that we've got a geography data type support in EF5, you can see that rather than having to have a query in the DB, we can just say location.distance and do our query like that. So that's pretty neat. So let's go to the push notifications one. We've got 5 minutes. So what do you guys think? Should I open up my completed solution, or should I try and be epic and get it in? Oh, damn. Okay, here we go. So what I want to do is on my my post method here, when I add that point of interest, it's the last thing that happens. I want to create a tile and send it. Tile and send. Now, I'm checking that the content we're uploading is a JPEG, and I'm using essentially a task to kick off another thread to create a thumbnail and send a notification. So let me generate these methods. Because the image we're uploading is much larger res than what we want to display on our start screen. So, creating a thumbnail. All right, and let me resolve these references. Again, thumbnail, we're just getting a reference to our storage account, pulling down the image, and then writing the thumbnail back with underscore thumb. And all right, and we got something here. Doesn't know what blob URL is because when I control dotted that, couldn't pick it up. And we want to set the image. So I'll post this code on my blog because we're going to have to sort of rush through it. But essentially, we grab the blob, we create a thumbnail from it, and write it back as underscore thumb. Now, to send a notification, there's a few key things we need to do. We need to come to manage.dev.live.com/build. We need to provide a package name and publisher. So once you do that, you get back some credentials, which are these. And rather than going through the wizard throughout time, I'm just going to show you how to use them. So we take that, we come over to our packaging tab, we put in our name here, and this is essentially sets up stuff for OAuth 2 so you can authenticate against WNS and ensure you're posting notifications to yourself rather than someone else's application. So we're going to install a couple of packages here. Install package WNS recipe. So WNS recipe is a nice managed wrapper that allows you to create notifications. It's got plenty of documentation there which you can view when you drop it in. And the second package I'm going to install is Windows Azure.notifications. Now this drops in a web API endpoint that allows you to push a channel up to send that notification through. So the basic method of sending push notifications is to say, on the client, request a channel that uniquely identifies a tile on your start screen, push that up into your cloud service and store it such that when you want to send a notification, you can retrieve that channel and send a notification. So what we need to do here now is say private iAccess token provider. Now these are things that we dropped in with those new packages. Token provider, WNS access. So this does the auth against WNS, and we use the other two credentials here for that. First one is the package SID. The second one is the client secret. We come across. Put that in. So that's that. Then I'm going to be a... Let's get rid of that so we've got some more space. I'm going to be Snippet Ninja. Now, essentially what we've got is when we dropped in the Windows Azure.notifications NuGet, it added this, which allows us to access those channels that we're registering up here. And the WNS recipe provides us a nice tile content factory to new up our tile and send the notification to a particular URI. So to get that URI on the client, we need to do a couple of things. So if you want wide notifications, you need to specify a wide tile. Select pictures, and this was my first attempt at creating something interesting, and that was my second. So we'll use that. And if you want to send toast, you hit yes. And then here on the client, we need one more thing. We need to specify, we've got 41 seconds, we might run a couple minutes over. Package Windows 8.notifications. Now, this is a nice little wrapper that we've created. Let me target the app. Nice little wrapper we've created that essentially wraps the push notification channel manager, which returns back a channel URI. So what we can do here is we can call into that and say, let's go to our navigated to, get rid of that rubbish, and let's say notify TFication client. Create a notification client, and we'll specify my app, and we'll call it client X. So you'd put in like a GUID or something to uniquely identify this device, and a registration endpoint. I'll host. Localhost. Almost done, sorry guys. Endpoints. We don't need API there because I haven't sort of registered the router's API in the NuGet package. And essentially we saw call client.register. And we'll call this main app tile. So build that. That works. One last piece of configuration, since we've been pointing at a public storage account this whole time, is we're going to have to specify not to use our local storage emulator, but rather use the real storage account that we've been using throughout this whole session. So let's do that. And that's coming from the data connection string. We'll come back to this guy and drop that storage account in there. And that should be ready to run. And then we'll call it there. You guys seen Scott Gu's demo, so the publish is essentially very easy. We won't run too far over time because I know the AV guys will get probably very mad at me. So let's hit debug start. We'll take a picture and we'll see it turn up on our start screen. Allow. Let's just jump straight to a picture. Allow. Okay, there we go. Do my Chrome Dome. Hit OK. So that should be going, pushing that up into storage. And then as we add that point of interest, should be then going and hopefully, if everything worked, should be eventually sending it down here. So it's probably creating the thumbnail, and there's my Chrome Dome. So let's close it there. So thank you. I'm sure there's another presenter that wants to come in here, so I'll be available for questions, perhaps off to the side. Thank you.